Well, first of all, the reason why the trial of Means and Banks and the other leaders was shifted to St. Paul was the pervasive prejudice toward Indians which occurs in South Dakota. The defense did a survey throughout the state of South Dakota, and our finding was that 60% of the people that we surveyed were irretrievably prejudiced against American Indians. Now, the government did a survey, and even their survey showed about 38% of the people that they talked to were prejudiced against
Indians. Now, why would their survey results be different from yours?
Very simply because the survey for the defense was conducted by young economists. He used law students who did telephone interviews, and he used a fairly sophisticated, reasonably intelligent way of asking questions. A sample, on the government side, a sample of people who had served on juries before was selected. They were sent this very short, simple, direct questionnaire, which asked them whether or not they knew Russell and Dennis. And then it asked a question, in terms of whether they thought they were guilty or not, and then asked a question about whether they thought they would be able to give them a fair trial. The respondent then had to take this letter down and have it notarized. So if you are prejudiced, and you say you're prejudiced, you're on record officially, the United States government is saying you're prejudiced. So the big discrepancy between the results, I think, between the anonymity, which is guaranteed in most legitimate survey work, and the fact that you're under oath, in a sense, you are under oath to...
Dick, you neglected to mention they had to take their completed questionnaire to the state attorney's office for notarization. And people who have to take their questionnaires to the state attorney's office and they expect that the state attorney or the U.S. attorney wants a certain answer, that's what they're going to give them. But you wanted to know whether St. Paul was... a decent place for this trial to occur. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, obviously, it's a lot better than South Dakota. But on the other hand, it's not quite as good as the Minneapolis district. The St. Paul Judicial District includes 9 counties which run north and south of St. Paul. And Minneapolis has all of these students and professionals, so many more than St. Paul, also more black people. So the kinds of people who would be more likely to share some of the concerns of the defendants are more present in the Minneapolis area than in the St. Paul area. The St. Paul Judicial District includes what is called the first and third divisions of the Minnesota Federal District, and that reaches from St. Paul to Owatonna, down through Rochester, up through Stillwater, and it's a very substantial area, but certainly not the whole state by any means.
And the Minneapolis, the district in which Minneapolis is located, you think would reflect a
somewhat more cosmopolitan population.
What is the technique of finding out who your jurors are likely to be, what their prejudices are, what their feelings are?
No, we first started this in Harrisburg, and Jay had been a friend of Akbar Ahmed at Cornell, and he was one of the defendants in the Harrisburg trial. He'd also been very friendly with Dan Berrigan, who was a Catholic chaplain at Cornell at that time. And so he was involved with the defense committee there, and because the Harrisburg area was seemed to be so conservative, and nobody knew too much about the people there, Jay managed to persuade the defense committee it might be a good idea to conduct a survey and find out a little bit about the population. And so we used standard techniques in terms of, we started off with a list of registered voters, picked every nth name, and there's 840 telephone interviews, which got fairly simple demographic information. And then we picked 240 people for very intensive face-to-face interviews from that. Now, there are about, 40 people that were involved in the interviewing project?
At least.
In Harrisburg. And these were all volunteers, like our time's volunteered too. I mean, this is simply because we believe that the government is trying to, frame is too strong a word, but do this. And our estimate on the whole Harrisburg operation was it probably cost about $400, which came from Defense Committee funds. This money they raised by contributions and so on. And my best estimate, the thing had been done commercially, it probably cost from $100,000 to $125,000. And I further have argued that they probably did a better job on interviewing than a commercial organization would, because you have dedicated volunteers who aren't horsing around. But anyway, that was how we got started in that one. And so we sort of developed since then. Maybe, Jay, you want to pick it up?
Yeah, I guess you're talking about the techniques we use.
The nature of the techniques, which I suppose would be applied to every situation, and yet the questions that you would ask would be specifically designed for each particular case.
Well, the techniques are always evolving, but the essence of the techniques are really perhaps five. There is a survey that Dick mentions, and the survey's purpose is to establish the social geography of the judicial district,
yes,
which is not usually known by almost anyone in the area. And it's not just a question of trying to say how many people are old, or how many people are white, or how many people are Lutheran, or how many people are Catholic. It's a question of trying to say, what is the interaction between age and religion and sex and occupation and education and a host of other things, and general social attitude, and in this case, attitude toward Indians. Or in the Gainesville trial, attitude toward Vietnam veterans. So we're constantly trying to look at background factors as they influence and shape general social attitudes, which have to do with attitude toward authority, which have to do with attitude toward government, attitude toward lifestyle. And then we're also trying to zero in on more specific kinds of attitudes, such as attitudes which might be related to the type of defendant and the type of crime those defendants are charged with. Now, it is impossible to go from the group information about Catholics or Lutherans or young Catholics or old Catholics to the individual who appears in the courtroom. We know is that he comes from, or she comes from, a particular social type. But there is a human being in the courtroom, a specific person. And so what we are trying to do in the courtroom is understand how that person presents himself or herself.
What gives you problems are people that are demographically bad but come across good, and you're trying to figure out whether they're lying or not, or whether there's simply a normal variation here in the demography isn't picking up their true attitudes. Or if the demography, the background variables, are good and they come across bad, then you wonder why they're doing that.
We are also now trying to assess the relationship between stance and body posture and face and such gestures as the person makes, and dominance and witness and involvement. These are kinds of dimensions which people who study kinesics think about. There is no science yet of kinesics, but we've all been impressed with the relationship between body and stance to various attitudes. And so there are a couple of people in the courtroom who are looking at that. Those are the in-courtroom techniques. Then we have an out-courtroom technique.
Can I break in for
sure.
Just a second? Because not only, well, Harvey's an anthropologist, and June Tapp, psychologist. She has two young graduate students from the University of Michigan working with her on this. I'm taking it. The defendants are taking it. We have a Creek Indian medicine man who is making observations. The two defendants are making observations. Ralph Ware, who is supposed to be here, isn't he supposed to be the only Indian in the United States with a PhD in psychology? Well, see, they're picking up different sorts of cues than we are, because they're more sensitized to the racial discrimination sort of thing. And this, I think, is very important. In Gainesville, for example, the one juror who had sized up everybody else on the jury was a 26-year-old black with 1 year of vocational school after college. But he lived in that area all his life. But he was very sensitized to whites, and he could predict exactly how every one of the whites who was going to respond to the issues in the trial in terms of the sort of arguments, with one mistake. He made the same mistake we did. He made a mistake there, too. But he was better than any other juror. Minority group members quite frequently, you know, have a special sensitivity to this sort of thing, and they're aware of things that we aren't. And, of course, since Indians are involved in the trial, it's very useful to have the Indians' evaluations because they pick up things we don't pick up.
Dick's mention of the input of the medicine men and also the defendants is an important sort of development for us, because in the past defendants have made contributions and important ones, but this is the first time we have been partners with a group of acute and knowledgeable men, or for that matter women, from a particular minority group from which defendants come, as if these are their spiritual leaders, and their spiritual leaders are engaged in this jury selection process as equal partners. Now that's a entirely new development for us.
I should say. A jury, of course, is supposed to be made up of peers of the defendants, and yet we don't see that any Indians have so far been selected. And is there, well, what chances are there that we will have
almost none? I think your listeners ought to understand a little bit about that. The government starts with an enormous edge in any criminal trial, because the people who are most represented in the jury wheel are the guardians of the norms of the community, and the people who are least represented are the people who are, let us say, out of joint with some of the norms of the community or challenging those norms. And this is especially true in relationship to minority groups, because the jury wheel is based upon registered voters, entirely upon registered voters in federal cases. So that I estimate there are 15,000 Indians in a population of 500,000 registered voters. And of those 15,000 Indian, I estimate that about 3,000 are registered voters. Well, you do the arithmetic, 3,000 out of 500,000, the chances of an Indian coming in a panel of 200,
yes,
are non-small.
Uh-huh.
And the chances of a black coming in, the chances of a Chicano coming in are non-small. Until the 18-year-old vote was passed, the chances of a young person coming in were non-existent.
How about this time?
This time we have a lot of young people. But then again, students don't choose to serve because they're in college. And so we've had quite a number of students who are 19, 20, 21 seek excuses. Now, we all know that young people have attitudes which are more, let us say, suspicious of authority than old people. But so many of the young people, particularly during the school year, opt out because of their commitment to their school. So here we have a situation where professionals are able to get excused. Teachers, for example, have a mandatory excuse under the jury plan. Professionals are almost non-existent. And young people are underrepresented. And blacks and Chicanos and Indians almost aren't there. So that those groups, which we all would agree would tend to be a little bit more suspicious of authority than most groups, are almost always underrepresented in the jury wheel.
Gentlemen, I want to ask you about publicity and the effect of publicity on selecting a jury. So far, we read in the paper that the prospective jurors, as I said earlier, are just practically innocent of any knowledge or awareness of Wounded Knee and the trial itself. Does this work in favor of the defense or opposed?
Well, before we deal with that, you should understand that this is not surprising. We went through a number of trials. In Harrisburg, almost no one knew anything about the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War had been going on for 9 or 8 years. There are some people in this country who believe that Americans are knowledgeable about important events. The fact is that most Americans simply don't know much about important events and don't respond very much to those important events.
So you're not surprised by the situation here?
Well, very specifically in Harrisburg, I don't think we had a single respondent out of 240 who could identify Elizabeth McAllister, who had been in the newspapers quite a bit. And this was, you know, about 2 months, I guess, before the trial started. 98% of them heard of Martha Mitchell. Johnny Carson, I think he got 96% or 98%.
Well, have you got any specific formula about the relationship between exposure to the media and presumption of guilt? I mean, are people who are well-informed likely to be...
We do a lot of research around these jury selections, and some work that we did suggested a relationship between exposure sensitivity and punitiveness. The more people are exposed, the more they become sensitized, the more likely they are to think in terms of people being guilty. And that was what we discovered from some of the work that we did around the Harrisburg trial. And that we submitted an affidavit based on this research in the Ellsberg trial, and that affidavit was apparently quite helpful in the dismissal of the first jury, which you may remember was impaneled. The government had had a tap on one of the trial lawyers' phone, and the trial was suspended, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Meantime, there was the presidential campaign, and Agnew was comparing the Ellsberg leaking of the Pentagon Papers to the break-in at the Watergate, and there was all of this exposure. And the appellate court actually overruled Judge Byrne and dismissed the first jury based upon some of our argument about the relationship between exposure, sensitivity, and punitiveness.
Can you draw any conclusions to apply to the Wounded Knee trial from your previous work? Would you be more apt to be more interested in a person who knew about Wounded Knee and had read a little history and who was familiar with the situation, or
this
are
I think
you
would
able
depend
to see,
upon a number of other variables that go into it. People can be interested in something because they're against them. But the point I'm trying to make is some people read about these cases because they know these people they feel very strongly that these people are a threat, and so they're very interested in news about it. On the other hand, you get some people at the other extreme who might be very sympathetic toward the Indians, who read books on Wounded Knee, who do this because they are generally interested. But these usually are a minority of the sample that you're going to get, mm-hmm. and people that are one extreme or the other are more likely to be more familiar with the background of the case.
There is a pervasive sympathy toward Indians in Minnesota. This is one of the findings that we have from our survey.
Oh, is that so? As compared to South Dakota, for example?
Yes. It's almost a romanticizing of Indians, perhaps because Indians have been no threat here in Minnesota, and they have been defined as a threat and as undesirable in South Dakota. Now, the problem is that the attitude toward Indians, which is generally sympathetic, is also present with very conservative attitudes. That is, the whole range of attitudes. There are conservative attitudes which go along with this sympathy, and liberal attitudes which go along with this sympathy. And so it's not really easy to understand what all of that means.
Yes.
The judge is conducting all the questioning mm-hmm. in the what is called the voir dire. Judge Nickel is doing a very extensive searching voir dire. And it is perfectly possible that he may, or anyone who is conducting a voir dire, might trigger off some kinds of sentiments or feelings, expose a raw nerve, or touch on something that was sort of locked away. That's always possible. But he's a very nice and non-authoritarian individual. And my guess is that he does not really do that very much with the prospective jurors. On the other hand, someone like Judge Hoffman might well bring out a lot of reaction, or someone like Judge Arno in Florida, who was a very ornery critter, certainly did that.
The judge has an enormous amount of control of this jury selection, obviously. And the question of whether or not he will sequester the jury has been raised.
The judge will decide that.
Yeah.
And he has made that clear that he might do it. And it's been surprising here how many people have been able to say, well, they still could serve on a sequestered jury, which means perhaps 4 to 5 months away from family, job. It means celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
It means a lot of things. And I've just been very surprised with how many people have said they could serve. Now, whether the judge will sequester or not, my guess is, will depend upon whether or not there is some event which he feels might contaminate the jury's capacity to render a fair decision. If there's some event which explodes in the media, or some disturbance which occurs, or lawyers or government or defendants begin flooding the media with too many sentiments, he might then feel that he has to insulate or protect the jury from all of this stimulus.
And then that jury becomes a social system all its own, doesn't it, with
sure.
its own set of dynamics. Do things change within that social structure? Would an opinion change? Somebody be influenced by the opinion of his fellow jurors or someone that he liked on the jury?
It is like being locked away in a submarine for 3 or 4 months. And everyone who has had that experience, or for that matter, on a ship voyage for 3 or 4 months. And that, of course, does mean that all kinds of queer and strange and weird dynamics begin to develop.
Yeah.
We have been right each time on who the foreperson of the jury would be, who the group would elect. And that is crucial to the whole process of trying to form a jury. If we are not able to think about who the probable leaders of that jury are going to be, then we haven't done our homework. We haven't really been thinking adequately about the interrelationships and the dynamics of the people we are trying to select. The system of criminal jurisprudence in the United States is really so not understood by almost all Americans. I don't think there are 100 people in the state of Minnesota outside of the legal profession, and there aren't so many in the legal profession who understand the system of criminal justice. It isn't taught in the schools. Where do people learn about it except if they've been victims? Perhaps ex-cons are the people who know more about it outside of the legal profession. And what I'm trying to sort of communicate is the enormous advantage the government has in any criminal trial, simply because of the composition of the jury wheel, the structure of the criminal system. And all we're trying to do is to slightly offset as much as we can that advantage by bringing together whatever intelligence we can to help the defense lawyers to get a reasonable jury. That does not assure a fair trial. It does not assure a fair trial. A fair trial is terribly hard to come by in the United States. And
or anywhere else.
Or anywhere else. The other thing I wanted to comment on, in the Camden trial, which is a trial in which many priests and nuns were involved, a Jesuit priest, observing hundreds of people, hundreds of ordinary Americans coming in and saying they knew nothing about the Vietnam War and it had not affected their lives, introduced a motion, they were representing themselves, introduced a motion to dismiss the panel for moral idiocy. The judge was very taken by that motion. I think we all were. And I think that's a characteristic of the American situation, which really does not get adequate discussion. Where were all of the Americans when the Vietnam War was going on?
Well, I thought they were watching their TV sets. How could they avoid?
Well, but that's not the picture that you get when you see, after all, 450 people come through the Harrisburg court, when you see 300-odd people come through the Camden Court, a random selection of the people from those judicial districts in central Pennsylvania, in southern New Jersey, in northern Florida, in Orange County, California, here also substitute Wounded Knee for
right.
the Vietnam War.
Are these observations, Mr. Shulman, something that could be used to provide the evidence that we need to change the system altogether?
Well, certainly I think that the system deserves immediate and complete changes, but how it's going to come about is a question which will take us long beyond the time that we have, and I don't really know the answer to that. But I certainly believe that there is a need for a fundamental change in the society.
And so that the work that you do is going to be of continuing importance, not only in trials of this nature, but in every kind of trial, would you say?
One of the things that's interesting on this is the fact that there are more political trials, people that are anti-war, pro-civil rights, pro-Chicano, this sort of thing, than I had imagined until you sort of traveled around the country. And what is happening, people are finding out about this, and it's people are beginning to think about this sort of process. So the ball is sort of beginning to snowball now a little bit in terms of the sorts of cases that are coming up. We're going to be involved in the Attica brothers trial. And that one, is going to be extremely rough because they moved the venue into Erie County, which brings in the city of Buffalo, which has got completely different characters than St. Paul. And one of the things I find fascinating about this is the sort of social geography of a particular judicial district is fantastically different from place to place. Harrisburg was not like Gainesville. St. Paul is not like either of them. And so what we basically have here are a set of techniques which we use, but you have to sort of plug in the variables that you come across in each particular judicial district.
There's also a terrible problem, I think, that Russ Means and Dennis Banks put it very well the other day. They said they would never go to trial again without the kind of support that is involved in this trial. And they were not just referring to the very good lawyers they have, they were referring to this jury project team,
yes,
which is involved as well. And the problem is that hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people accused of felonies in the country cop pleas, not because they are necessarily guilty, but they cannot afford the risk of a jury trial, given the advantages that the government has and given the lack of resources that they have. And so one of our problems is to try to generate a way of extending these techniques so that people who are ordinary felons,
yes,
may have the advantage of
them.
And that's a terribly hard problem, but it's surprising, as Dick was saying, how many people are beginning to sort of think about these techniques and use them. And if they are used a lot, what I can begin to see happening is that in places like New York or Chicago, very large cities, charged felons will begin to opt for jury trials. Now, only 1% of all of the charged people,
yeah,
have jury trials. And if that moves to 5%, that will put enormous pressure on the whole court system and oblige very real changes in that system.
Well, will social psychologists and scientists such as yourselves then be hired by the court to do these inquiries, or will that be up to the defendant himself to find his team of surveyors? I wonder how that will...
Well, we're going to have to experiment with that. That's a very hard situation. If you work for the Legal Aid Society, or you work for Public Defender's Office, you work, in effect, for the government.
Yeah.
And it's not at all clear how one can generate the sorts of services that are required without becoming associated, even in a kind of arm's length way, with the with the other side. That's a very difficult problem that has to be solved if these techniques are going to be able to become available to ordinary felons.
Well, Mr. Shulman, Mr. Christie, I want to let you go. I just wrote down a quote from your Psychology Today article in which you said, "Both the Nixon administration and its radical critics misrepresent and misunderstand the values and psychodynamics of these Americans," meaning the jurors who were served in the Harrisburg trial. And I took that as an optimistic comment, and I'm not sure, after hearing you this morning, whether that's interpreted that right or not.
One of the things that I have been very impressed with has been, once you screen out the more obviously bigoted individuals, and like most of the jurors, for example, in Harrisburg, didn't know that much about the case ahead of time. They, you know, were in it. Mm-hmm. Ill-informed and this sort of thing. But they take very seriously the judge's charges, you know, about have to be proved guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is the optimistic note. You know, once they understand exactly what's going on here, and of course we have been in trials where the government's case was, you know, they were relying upon paid informers, there were discrepancies. These guys are coming across like $3 bills, Boyd Douglas in Harrisburg, yeah. Lemur and the others in Gainesville. And one of the things, maybe I ought to give an example of a young woman in Gainesville who's 25 years old. Politically, she said she was beginning to think of herself a liberal. She never thought of herself politically before. But what got her in that particular trial was when the first informer was on the stand, the prosecution team is sitting directly in front of the jury box. And while the witness is on the stand, you know, most of them are looking up there. And all of a sudden, she noticed that when the witness didn't remember the answer to the question, one of the prosecuting attorneys who was out of the Justice Department in Washington was pulling his ear, and the man didn't remember anything. Or he'd scratch his chin, and the man would remember. Oh. And she couldn't believe her eyes. She literally couldn't believe her eyes. They've taken the judge's instructions extremely seriously. They're not supposed to discuss any aspect of the case. For the next 2 weeks in that trial, she's sitting there wondering whether she's hallucinating or not. I mean, this is the United States of America. This can't possibly happen here. But there it was. So as soon as they got in the jury room, she immediately asked some of the other women that she was fairly close to in the jury whether they noticed anything about the prosecutor or not. "You mean that signaling bit," they said. These five women had all picked this up independently. They were all shocked and horrified by it, but they wouldn't say anything about it because those were the judge's instructions. You know, this is the optimistic note, is people take this responsibility very seriously if you can just get rid of the kooks and nuts.
I think that if most Americans could in fact participate as jurors in these kinds of trials, they would not be the same again. And the problem, it seems to me, is that the media does not do its job in trying to project what this experience is on these people so that other Americans here in Minnesota can begin to understand what Wounded Knee was about and what these 18 jurors, 12 jurors and 6 alternates, will experience in this 4 or 5 month trial. It's like the moral equivalent of combat. And the media simply has no idea of how to cover this kind of thing so that Americans who are watching the media and having to learn from the media can begin to place themselves in the same situation that those 18 people. They don't even really talk to those 18 people in any way, shape, or form, which enables them to convey to their fellow citizens what it meant to go through such an experience. We were down in Gainesville after that trial. We came back with 100 hours of tape material. Press doesn't do that. Radio people don't do that. Television people don't do that. What's wrong with all of you?
A very weak analogy on this would be people's watching the Watergate Senate hearings last summer. That, you know, I think got more people. All of a sudden, these aren't cold people whose names in the headline, you know, are doing this. All of a sudden, they see Ehrlichman on the stand or Haldeman on the stand, and they respond directly to what is going on here, and all of a sudden, they are, you know, really taken aback. Now, of course, that is not nearly as vivid as being in a jury box where you have the responsibility of life or death or, you know, a good portion of somebody's life. You're still sort of a participant. So it's not nearly as strong an impression. And, of course, you don't pick up nearly as much on the TV set as you do in the courtroom. But on the media in terms of Watergate coverage, I think that was a very good educational sort of experience in which you could actually see these characters on the stand evading questions, the sort of thing you don't pick up when you don't get the emotional impact you get when you just read a headline or skim a story very quickly.
Richard Christie and Jay Shulman, I thank you very, very much for taking time out to come and talk to us today.
Okay, thank you.